Last week, beloved, Gideon was encouraged by an enemy's dream, as I trust we were too. Midianite soldier number one was a prophet for the night, receiving direct revelation from God in a dream. Midianite soldier number two played the part of a Joseph or a Daniel in interpreting the dream. And within 24 hours, both of them were dead, and the dream had come true. Midian was routed. Now we come to the battle itself, what I'm calling a most unorthodox battle. By unorthodox here, I do not mean heretical, a heretical battle, as if that would make sense. Unorthodox here is not used in the sense of unorthodox doctrine. By unorthodox here, I'm referring to it in terms of the normal accepted rules of warfare. That's Judges 7, a most unorthodox battle. You just don't fight like that. This unorthodox battle, though, is not going to be preached upon with an unorthodox sermon. There's a difference. Now, there's much that is strange or unusual, even in the events preceding this unorthodox battle. First of all, as we've seen, Israel's army, though less than a quarter the size of the enemy, was too many. Over 99% of them were sent back home, and again we say this is not textbook military procedure. Second, Israel's commander was given so many signs and reassurances, more than any other figure in all the Bible. That's unusual too. Fire arose out of a rock to consume Gideon's meat and bread in a sacrifice. That's unusual. The angel of the Lord vanishes before Gideon's eyes. Then there was the miracle of the fleece, a miracle in two parts. And finally came the blessed eavesdropping and the marvelous dream of which I've spoken earlier. And after these strange events, we're almost prepared and almost expecting an unusual method of warfare. And it was most unorthodox, this battle. Who ever heard of 300 men attacking 135,000 men, the 300 carrying only trumpets, pitchers, and torches? That's unorthodox. One author remarked that this is one of the military marvels of antiquity. Indeed, the Bible, which gives us some remarkable battles, of them all, this is the most unorthodox way of fighting, with the possible exception of the conquest of Jericho, when the walls came tumbling down. And often we think of this battle in Judges 7 and that battle in Joshua 6 together, because they stand out as really strange ways of fighting the enemy. And then to cap this unorthodox battle, Israel doesn't so much as lay a finger on one Midianite. The enemy soldiers slaughter each other. And it's only later, we'll look at this next week, God willing, only later, when Midian flees the plain of Jezreel, that the Israelites themselves begin to draw enemy blood. Consider then this most unorthodox battle. First of all, the attack of the Israelites, then the rout of the Midianites, and finally, the greatest unorthodoxy, so to speak, of them all, the offense of the cross. Let's think first then of the weaponry of the 300 Israelites. As regards defensive armaments, the 300 men had none. No shields, large or small, nothing. In fact, the men of Gideon didn't even have a spare arm to carry such protection if they had been allowed it. Their offensive weapons are even more amazing. Think, for instance, of the book of Judges. Ehud at least had a dagger. Jael had her tent peg. Shamgar had an ox goad or a cattle prodder. Samson had the jawbone of an ass. But Gideon and his 300 men don't have one sword among them, nor even a single tent peg, ox goad, or donkey's jawbone. Nothing. In fact, properly speaking, they had no offensive weapons at all, as well as no defensive armaments. O Gideon, you mighty man of valor, here you are with no weapons, no shields, 300 against 135,000, and off you go to your first and maiden battle, and what hope would you ever have of returning? That's the idea. It's a highly unorthodox battle. So what does Israel bring with them? Three things. A trumpet. This trumpet would not have been made of brass or any metal. The trumpet here was a ram's horn trumpet. Trumpets of silver are mentioned in connection with warfare in Numbers 10. There were two silver trumpets. Here we have 300 ram's horn trumpets. The two silver trumpets were to be blown, amongst other occasions, at the start of the battle. These 300 ram horn trumpets were blown throughout the battle, as we'll see. The other two objects beside the trumpets were pitchers and a torch. The pitcher was an earthenware vessel designed for carrying water. It was large enough to fit over the top of a burning torch and allow that burning torch enough oxygen to continue to burn. The lamp in the text is, as I've indicated, a burning torch, probably made of a resinous wood, smeared with a pitchy substance and then set alight. So trumpet, torch on fire with pitcher over the top. That's the situation. Wielding these highly unorthodox weapons, which God has provided for them, Israel's tiny army takes up its position as Gideon commands. First of all, the 300 are divided into three companies of 100 men each, with Gideon commanding one of them, probably the central 100, as would usually be the case. As Gideon directs, these 300 men in their three companies surround the Midianite camp. Roughly speaking, we have 100 of them to the north, 100 of them to the west, and 100 of them to the south of the enemy camp. We should also add that Gideon's men were on the hills or mountains surrounding the Midianites. And both the elevation of the Israelites' forces and the opening to the east, because I mentioned north, west and south, but not east, both of these things are important, as we'll see later. Now, having considered Israel's weaponry and position, we need to look at the timing of the attack. Verse 19 says specifically that it was the beginning of the middle watch, when the Midianites had but newly set the watch. In the Old Testament, there were three night watches. There was the morning night watch. That period just before the sun arose. It's mentioned in Exodus 14 and 1 Samuel 11. Then there's the middle night watch mentioned here. And if there's a middle, it comes in between one on either side. So it must be, by inference, there must be also a first night watch, which starts when it begins to get dark. First night watch, sun's going down, middle night watch, and then morning night watch, which ends with the rising of the sun. In the New Testament, we read of four, not three, watches. Probably this is because the Jews later on adopted the scheme of four night watches from the Romans. But here, Old Testament, three night watches. And now we're told here that this was at the beginning of the middle watch, and that's deliberate. In the middle watch, it was very dark. There were no lingering rays from sunset. There was no light from the beginning of the dawn. It was the darkest period of the 24-hour cycle. At that time, therefore, just about everybody is sleeping. The people who go to bed late, they're sleeping. The people who it takes a long time to fall over to sleep, they're probably sleeping too, if ever they get to sleep. And then the people who rise particularly early, well, none of them would be getting up this early. So this is as good a time as any if you want everybody asleep in the darkest period of the night. And all this, of course, is good for Gideon's men because since it's so dark and since the people are sleeping, it's easier for him to hide his forces, and then this will add the element of surprise. That's why they attack at this time of the night. And in this connection, we also ought not miss the fact that Israel attacked, if attack is the right word, Israel attacked at the beginning of the night watch. And verse 19 tells us it was the beginning of the middle watch when they had but newly set the watch. At this time, the eyes of the new watchmen would not yet be fully accustomed to the darkness. At this time, these men wouldn't be properly adjusted, and so they'd be more jumpy and nervous. So that's the point about the timing. Then, following Gideon's example, the silence and the darkness are suddenly broken. First of all, we hear the sounding of the trumpets. A single blast, quickly followed by 300 blasts, all blending into one terrifying cacophony, rending the deep silence, and 135,000 men, besides women and children, are rudely awakened in the dead of night. What's that? What's that? Dazed and confused. You can just picture them. What's happening? The next thing they hear is the smashing of pitchers. Breaking glass, or breaking pottery, is at the best of times a disconcerting and upsetting sound. And here, rudely awakened out of their sleep, they hear this loud shattering all around them. What in the world's going on? And this was immediately followed by the shining of the torches. And remember, in those days there were no street lights and no electricity. You don't flip a switch and immediately you have light. Light doesn't come suddenly and in the middle of the night. But here, the light's all around them and above them. And they're terrified, blinking, unaccustomed to this bright light. Where did it come from? Unaccustomed to the glare. And added to the mix, we can picture the terrified sentries sounding the alarm. Something terrible's happening. Ah, we can see that. We can hear it. And then, sounding as a death knell upon Midian, comes the shouting of the battle cry. The sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And if there were any doubts before, now even they are gone. It's an Israelite attack. And that dread name, Jehovah, the sword of the Lord, that would have scared them. Because the Midianites, as all the ungodly, know that Jehovah is different from all the idle, foolish speculations of the pagans. That he is the true and living God. And this name Gideon too also evokes fear. That Midianite dreamer and the interpreter were afraid of the name Gideon. This is nothing else, says the second one. This is nothing else, this dream, than the sword of Gideon, that son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has delivered us into his hand. And the battle cry deliberately played on such terror. And all of this together, the blaring trumpets, the smashing pitchers, the shining torches, the battle cries, it's too much for the Midianites. Confusion reigns throughout the camp. All the host runs and cries and flees, and then they start attacking each other. Then we come to another unusual and wise feature of the Israelite offensive. Well, the enemy's running around like headless chickens, and some of them were losing their heads to the swords of their fellows. The Israelites merely stood. Verse 21 emphasizes that. And they stood, every man in his place round about the camp. 300 disciplined men, the best soldiers. That was why God kept the best sort. They could keep and hold their ranks. So the Midianites at this stage are massacring each other. There's no need. No need for Gideon's men to get in the way. If they join in, they might get hurt. They're doing a good enough job on their own. Just let them have at it. Besides, Gideon's 300 men didn't have swords anyway. Unless you expect them to go around the camp beating them over the head with their trumpets, because their pitchers have already been smashed. So the 300 men merely continue to blow their horns and wave their torches, further encouraging the melee below as the Midianites hack each other to bits and their bloodied bodies crumple to the ground. This rout, therefore, of the Midianites began and continued with fear. A fear provoked by unexpected, sudden, terrifying sounds and lights and cries. A fear which was stirred by the dread names Jehovah, the unchangeable God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, and that other name, Gideon, whom God had raised up as judge. This fear arose at the deepest level from their own guilty consciences and the terror of the true and living God, whom they had not worshipped or served, but whose name they had tried to blot out by their idolatry, substituting their vanities for the maker of heaven and earth. And they knew the judgment that awaited them, and that was coming early. This fear led the Midianites to fight. And these men fought in a frenzy. They fought amidst the moving shadows. They fought as those who were blinded and terrified. And they fought each other in one great battle of self-destruction. Strange, though, that the battle cry was the sword of the Lord and Gideon. Gideon didn't use a sword. He didn't need to. He didn't even bring a sword. The sword of Gideon was in effect, and the sword of the Lord was in effect, the Midianites' own swords. And here is the fulfillment of the dream. The barley breads tumbling into the camp, and the big tent has fallen over headlong. This is, according to Psalm 83, this is God not keeping silence. This is God wakening up as a man of war and roaring at the Midianites, roaring through the trumpets, roaring through the battle cries and the shattering of earthenware pitchers. O God, keep not silence. Wake up and shout at them. And he did. And they slaughtered each other. There are a few other instances in the Old Testament where the enemy literally fights itself. One of them is found in 1 Samuel 14, verse 20, in the days of King Saul. The Philistines slaughtered themselves. They slaughtered themselves in part because they were terrified through the earthquake. The ground shook underneath them and it deranged them. And they started massacring and hacking at anybody who was near them, friend or foe. We looked at that in a sermon a few months ago. The other instance also occurred in a sermon, this one on Jehoshaphat, the ecumenical king, and it occurs in 2 Chronicles chapter 20. Jehoshaphat leads out his forces, or rather, the singers lead out the forces, praying and praising God for his mercies endure forever against the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Edomites, this army consisting of three armies. And then internal jealousies awake between these three nations. Ammon and Moab, descended from two brothers, the sons of Lot, conspire against the Edomites. They're a bit different from us. So Ammon and Moab turns and slaughters the Edomites. And then, having gotten an appetite for blood that day, the Ammonites look meanly at the Moabites, who become suspicious of them, and then the two of them fall into attacking each other, and they wipe each other out, and Jehoshaphat gets to the battlefield. Well, they've all killed each other, nobody to fight. All that's left for us is to take the plunder. Here, it wasn't an earthquake or rivalry between three different groups in the enemy camp, but here it was out of sheer blind terror provoked by the sudden sounds and light that they thought they were attacking Israelites, but they were killing each other. Eventually, the Midianites, unabated fear, led those who were still standing to flight. Proverbs 28 verse 1 says, "The wicked flee when no man pursueth," and there was nobody chasing them. And here we think of the gap to the east. There were no torches there. So that was the exit route they took. And then they headed south, as later in the chapter it describes, which we'll look at next week. But we need not only to consider the Midianites' fear and fighting and flight. We need to consider, too, God's government of his enemies. Because the text itself makes a point of this in verse 22. The 300 blew the trumpets, and the Lord set every man's sword against his fellow. The Lord of hosts was just as sovereign over Israel as he is over the Midianites, the enemies. God's government is just as much over you and me as it is over his ungodly, reprobate enemies. God's sovereignty over his enemies includes not only their thoughts, not only their deeds, not only their swordplay, but their thoughts. These are Israelites surrounding us. Their emotions. We're scared. All of their terror, God put it into their hearts. The proverb says that the heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. and like the rivers, he turns them whatever way he will. And God had the heart of every last Midianite in his hand, and their emotional response of fear and terror, he put there. And so they butchered each other. And God, the true God, the sovereign, governs every last one of his enemies. And he does this especially for his own great purpose of saving his Catholic Church. Think, for instance, of the Huguenots in the 16th century. How often the ungodly wanted not only to massacre them by the tens of thousands, but to wipe out every last Protestant in the country. But the royal court was so filled with jealousy, backbiting, envy, discord, that they often fell out with each other just when the hammer blow was supposed to strike. God governs the thoughts and fears of his enemies. Along similar lines, the great reformed city of Geneva at the same time and after was especially detested as that execrable city of heretics. So you have the French forces to the west and the forces of Spain and the Holy Roman Empire and the Pope and soldiers in the Roman Catholic cantons of Switzerland and in Italy. And how often various ones of them wanted to mount an all-out attack on Geneva and totally destroy that city and church and theological academy. But then the Pope would fall out with the French king, and the French king would quarrel with the emperor, and they just never managed to do it. Because God governs his enemies, even their emotions and fears and quarrels and hatreds and jealousies, for the good of his church. This highly unorthodox battle, though, is not the most unorthodox battle in the 66 books of the Bible. The most unorthodox battle of all the lot is undoubtedly the cross of Jesus Christ. Very unorthodox. Very unorthodox in the eyes of the Greeks. 1 Corinthians 1 says that they seek after wisdom. That's the great pursuit of life, to be wise. What wisdom is there in a king being rejected by his people? What wisdom is there in a Savior who comes to bring eternal life dying? What wisdom is there in a man despised and disgraced as a criminal? No wisdom in that. The Jews seek after a sign, that same chapter, 1 Corinthians 1 says, and to them the whole affair of Christ, all of it, was unorthodoxy and heresy. His behavior on the Lord's Day, then called the Sabbath, most unorthodox. His criticisms of the established church of its day, highly irregular. We expected, we have prayed for a Messiah who would be a great conquering king. And then this one comes as a hated and despised crucified criminal, as a blasphemer, as a false prophet, they judged him. Where's the power of God in this? Where's the wisdom of God? Where is his holiness in this hated rebel being crucified? They even said that as he hung on the cross. How's this one going to save anybody? He can't even save himself. Look at him, helpless on that tree. This is the end of him. And so the greatest unorthodoxy and the greatest heresy in the history of the church, as judged by the false church, was the greatest orthodoxy and truth and battle of all the ages. And this way, the way of the cross, and it's foreshadowed here in Judges chapter 7, is the way in which God alone gets the glory. There was only one on the cross, not even 300. And there was the wisdom of God, showing the hatred of the world and the false church in destroying his well-beloved Son. There was the power of God, because God there was atoning for sins in the body of his beloved Son. And God was soon going to raise him from the dead and give him victory over Midian and all his enemies. That's the lesson of Judges 7. It must have been God, because that's an unorthodox way of fighting. It must be the true and living God. And this highly irregular, unorthodox, atoning work of Christ on the cross comes to us today in the power of gospel preaching, in which a minister who's likened to a clay vessel, fragile, easily broken, unattractive, proclaims the gospel of the power and wisdom and glory of God. And this way too is God's way, because it's a way in which God alone gets the glory. Because how in the wide world could the Creator and Lord and Governor, how could he do that through a man standing up on a Sunday morning and explaining something from an old book? And then who does he save? The nobodies, a small group of people, the remnant. A most unorthodox battle, which is highly orthodox and victorious. Amen.